I personally think if you look at our lineup this year, I think we're a deeper team. I think in this league, to win consistently, you need three or four lines scoring each and every night. Can't rely on some guys to do it, and that's when we were at our best a few years ago, when we had a lot of players chipping in each night. You need to play six defensemen, you need to play four lines most of the nights, and I think we're a deeper team this year.
I really believe in our core. This is a core that's got us to Stanley Cup Finals just a few years ago. I believe we're all still in our prime. I think we're hungrier than ever. I think being that close and not winning and having a couple tough years since then has got us all very motivated.
I know for myself, I looked at myself in the mirror once the year was done and was really disappointed the way I played, and obviously wanted to work hard this summer and come back much stronger and have a good year this year, and I'm sure everybody on our team did the same, and I know guys look fit right now. Guys came in early. And
welcome to episode 24 of C4 from CHB. That's CanucksHockeyBlog.com. I am your host, Chris Golden, at Lightforce on Twitter, joined as always by Matt Lee, who is at MattLee980. Clay Emu, who is at Canuck Clay, he's actually not in the studio tonight. He's handling some business away from the mic. Now, Matt, we've got ourselves a huge podcast coming up. We're going to dissect training camp, which is well underway. We're going to explore the mind that is the new head coach, Willie Desjardins, as October 8th draws closer. We have absolutely no idea of what the lines will look like when the Canucks drop the puck on a brand new season. However, we've been getting a glimpse of it, at least in the first week of camp.
Yeah, and you said it. This is a jam-packed podcast. We're also going to be talking about former Canuck. That's right. Former Canuck Ryan Kesler, who made some splashy in the wave of Canuck land with his remarks about his final season in Vancouver, his trade demand, and his bitter divorce from the city.
Hey, speaking of Kesler, it's a flashback to 2011, as we'll be joined by former NHL scribe and show host Bruce Daubigan of Calgary. Bruce, he's the author of a brand new book called Ice Storm, which chronicles the rise and the fall of the greatest Vancouver Canucks team in history. Bruce is going to link up with us a little bit later in the show, and he's going to give us an inside look at what his book is all about.
We don't look at this as a rebuild or anything. I think we have a deep team, and we have a team that can make the playoffs, and anything can happen there. So I think, yeah, maybe from the outside they're lower, but within the team I think we have high expectations.
I think we're pretty confident and comfortable with the direction that we're going and with the feel in the dressing room, and we know where our expectations are.
I've known a couple guys that played for him at the junior level and in the American League level, and I hear nothing but positive things, and I'm excited to get to know him.
Yeah, everything you've heard about Willie is kind of the same things we've been hearing, like players coach, great communicator, wants to win, wants an open dialogue with his players, so great reviews from everybody I've talked to.
You just heard from Henrik Sedin, Daniel Sedin, and Chris Higgins, and given what all three of them have just said, expectations are reasonably high for this team. The number one goal is what Daniel just said, making the playoffs. You buying this hype, Matt?
Well, it's not like the team is going to go out and say at the very start of main camp, you know, we're just going out there and we're going to compete as hard as we can, because already it sounds like you're behind the eight ball. So given that, I think that this team is setting themselves up pretty well for the rest of the season. They have that expectation of making the postseason. It's not completely unreasonable. So to an extent, I am buying the hype. I mean, what are your thoughts?
Well, this is the perfect season for the Canucks to actually achieve anything, and the fan base will probably be like, oh, okay, that was better than last year. But to me, as we continue to hear this message reinforced, oh, we're a playoff team, we're making the playoffs, we're going to go and we're going to put together a run, could ultimately convince that fan base falsely that they're a lot closer than they happen to be. I'd rather just hear them say, hey, we're going to fight every night and we're going to fight for a spot in the playoffs. And hey, you never know what happens once you've made the group of 16.
But you know what bothers me is the fact that they still believe in this core. I mean, you heard Chris Higgins earlier. He says, I believe in this core. He keeps drawing back to 2011. And you know, I didn't agree with a lot of things that John Tortorella had said or done last season, but he did make a good point about how this team does have to stop living in the past, stop thinking about 2011. Don't you agree about that at all?
Well, would you expect him to say, I actually don't believe in this core as part of the core?
Well, yeah, but I think that making these comparisons to 2011 is still something that this team should let go.
Hey, this is the same market that's continued to make comparisons to 94, and you want us to let go of 2011 already?
I guess that's a good point.
Well, I mean, it's a fair question to ask, because like one of the first things Willie Desjardins was asked was just that, was whether or not he believed the Corps was stale, and he said no, not at all. In fact, he says they're motivated. So how much is motivation playing a factor?
It plays a huge factor. You know, there's nothing, I mean, Billy Beane in Moneyball said this once, and he said, "I hate losing. I hate losing more than I love winning." And I firmly believe that I'm in the camp of those people who believes that losing stays with you more than winning does. So I think the Canucks have been, you know, labeled as losers for the last few years. And I think that they've got a lot to prove against their critics that might be in this fan base. And I think that that creates some motivation that should bode well for them going into the season.
So the motivation, where is it coming from? I mean, the critics have always been present.
Past failures. I mean, that's really what it draws back to. This team was supposed to get back on that horse last year with John Tortorella as their new head coach. He was supposed to be the guy who pushed them over that hump, and instead he brought them a whole huge step back. And, you know, the Sedins are in the back nine of their careers, and they know that this chance to get back, at least in the Stanley Cup playoffs, is not going to be an easy one, and they have to get back there. And I think that that motivation does play a factor, and not just the Sedins, but the rest of the team trying to get back into the postseason.
Well, it's funny you mentioned Tortorella as he compares to Desjardins, because in a departure from the Torts era, the lengthy one-year Torts era, Willie actually traveled to meet all of the veterans. This is obviously in stark contrast from anything that John Tortorella would have done. So what do you take from that?
I think it shows some proactiveness from Willie Desjardins, if that's actually a real word, but I think that it's a guy who's trying to meet his new team. He's trying to get his feet wet with his players, break bread, for lack of a better phrase. And I think he wants to get an idea of where this team is at mentally, where they think they're at mentally and physically. And I think it gives him an idea of how to gauge this team heading into the season. And I think that's due diligence on his part. That's something that, as a new head coach for the first time ever in the NHL, he should be doing. And I think it gives him some perspective going into the season, which is very much needed.
Okay, well, I mean, fair enough. I actually look at it as a sign of how fractured that core may have been, and that's simply Willie Desjardins laying down the law, or at least laying down that foundation to say, here's who I am, and here's what I feel you'll do as part of this new system. But some other things that came out of training camp, for instance, this whole three goaltender theory that we've been bouncing around, what's going to happen.
This is really screwed up, don't you think?
Well, no doubt. Here we were talking about, okay, which of the two, Lack or Markstrom, do the Canucks lose? And now suddenly the Canucks, knowing that this is probably going to be the case, are playing with the idea that they actually have three goaltenders on the roster. And when you're looking at the team, I think they can have a maximum of 23 on a roster.
Yeah.
So it's ludicrous that you would go and put a goaltender up in the press box to simply ride not the pine but the, you know, polyester, you know, seat cover. Okay, else would it be?
So let's say that Willie Desjardins is going with the idea of three goaltenders, and it's a 23-man roster. You're looking at 13 forwards, 7 defensemen, and 3 goaltenders. Don't you think that, I mean, it's hard to give Willie Desjardins some crap on the first day of the job, but don't you think that that extra spot would be better reserved for, say, a forward?
Well, no doubt. And but again, goaltenders who aren't playing go stale.
I don't know. I mean, this thing, he also said that this was because of potential injury concerns. I mean, is he anticipating Ryan Miller and or Eddie Lack to get hurt down the stretch here at all?
Well, based on the Canucks' history, it's quite possible. But regardless of this, again, you have a stale goaltender who's going to move from the seat in the press box to the seat on the bench and then back up to the press box when it's all said and done. Yeah. And even if that goaltender, whether it be Lack or Markstrom, and I'm going to put money on it would be Markstrom as the third wheel, when he actually gets into a game, which will be never,
he's going to be rusty.
Oh, no doubt. Like, if we thought it was horrible when Tortorella didn't like the look of Markstrom and wouldn't play him until he had killed Lack and the Canucks' chances of making the playoffs, it's like the same thing, deja vu, all over again.
This might be some overreaction on my part, but I feel that Markstrom would be best served at least gambling on sending him back down to to Utica than it would be for him to work one-on-one with Rolly Melanson in practices and get maybe one of every 20 games a start in the NHL. Because that's basically what we're looking at if both goalies stay healthy.
Well, but let's bank on the fact that they both play, or they're both healthy and they both play.
Sure.
he rides the pine until such time as the team decides it makes no sense to carry that much money in the press box.
Do you think that there's the possibility, now this is a new thing I'm thinking, do you think that they want to start with three goaltenders in training camp and going into the season because this is the time when teams are looking for an actual situation or someone to fix their problems in net, and that they'll try and sneak Markstrom back down maybe in November, December when there's less of a demand for a goaltender?
Okay, fine. I can't knock that theory. It does. But if I'm an opposing general manager and I see an asset like Markstrom hit the waiver wire, why would I not take the shot at bringing him to my roster and having him simply go through down to my minor league team?
Well, I mean, perhaps by November, December, there are teams that have other pressing concerns which are greater than picking up a goaltender who has, let's be honest, some red flags to him. I think that there are teams out there by November and December who are looking to add either offense or someone on the back end to help bolster their blue line.
Sure, but there's no reentry anymore. So, you're telling me that the risk of bumping yourself down the waiver wire lineup is big enough that you would pass that opportunity up? Like, there's enough NHL teams that someone at the end of the line will be like, oh, thank you.
I don't know. The whole prospect of carrying three goalies is still something that confuses me. So
sure. Well, the other thing that confuses me is Alex Burrows is suddenly playing on the left side to Nick Bonino and Zach Cassian. So is this something that's just to shake things up, or is it just based on the situation that's in front of us?
Alex Burrows says he feels okay or at least comfortable playing on the left side. I don't buy it personally. This is a guy who's made a career out of playing shotgun to the Sedins on the right wing, and now he's suddenly going to be asked to play on the left wing. I think that's a bit of a stretch to say that it's going to be a permanent solution. That said, it's something that I think Willie Desjardins is at least kicking his tires on. However, he also said that these lines that he's going with at the start of training camp here are the lines he has an idea will be part of his opening night roster. So going off of that logic, it's very possible we'll see Radim Vrbata on the right side of the Sedins on the first line, Alex Burrows on the left on the second line with Bonino and Cassian on the right. So I don't know. I don't know if this is going to work for a long period of time.
Well, let's look at the preseason. The preseason occurs, and that's the opportunity where in the first few games you experiment, you explore. And I actually look at Burrows maybe not so much as playing well on the left side, but actually playing well to the role he's assigned on the second line.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong. I mean, it's not like it's day and night, the transition between right wing and left wing. Alex Burrows is still going to go out there and do the things that's made him a successful player, such as, you know, a hard, aggressive forecheck, trying to get the pucks off the guy in the deep in the defensive zone, and he'll try and get the puck back either to the point or Nick Bonino up the middle. So his game won't change too much, but playing an entirely different side is something that should be completely foreign to Burrows.
Hmm. Well, another player, and I mean, it's sort of being that we're on the second line, you know, is Bonino, and how he got a glowing endorsement from Pierre Maguire, which means as far as Bonino is concerned, we should probably be concerned.
He's a monster.
He's a monster, yeah. I mean, Pierre Maguire goes on and says, I'll tell you right now, he's going to surprise so many people that have no idea who Nick Bonino is. Nick Bonino is a very highly cerebral player who has tremendous skills and can distribute the puck really well. If Alex had his speed back and his competitive fire back and is injury-free, I think that's a real nice combination.
Look, I was very on the fence about Nick Bonino when the Canucks acquired him for Ryan Kesler. To this day, I'm still unsure. I mean, all I know about Nick Bonino is he was a pretty okay guy on the second unit for a deep Anaheim team. But, you know, this is a guy who's sort of been in the shadows of guys like Corey Perry and Ryan Getzlaff over the years. And now he's suddenly being asked to not only be a top six player on the Vancouver Canucks, he's being asked to be the guy to replace Ryan Kesler, and those are big boots to fill, whether you think that it's fair or not. So I'm a little more skittish on Nick Bonino being a top six player. I do know, however, that Pierre Maguire has seen enough of Nick Bonino over the last few years to know that he's probably a decent player. That said, is it enough to suggest that Nick Bonino is going to be a guy who can, let's say, score 25 goals and 25 assists this season? Do you think that's a bit of a stretch?
Yes.
Exactly.
And where he is today is a great third line center that you want to develop into that second line role. And
do you worry about stunting his development by being asked to play a bigger role than he's capable of?
No, I actually, I think Bonino, he occurs to me as the type of player who's going to step up to that opportunity and probably do well with it. But what's he playing with? Like, I'm not knocking Burrows and I'm not knocking Cassian, but we have a lot of ifs associated here. If that's the second line, and even McGuire says, if Burrows gets his speed back, if he gets his competitive fire back, if he's injury free, and then Zach Cassian, who granted was one of the better Canucks late last season, he's inconsistent at best. So for Bonino, you've got puzzle piece A and puzzle piece B beside him. And do those three puzzles belong to the puzzle pieces belong to the same set? No clue. The other sort of question mark, and we're obviously seeing
the other
this,
puzzle piece.
The other puzzle piece within this giant puzzle. Bo Horvat starts in the middle between Derek Dorsett and Sean Matthias. And I just want to point out, Sean Matthias actually hit a hole-in-one this weekend in Whistler. I had already earlier said, is that the closest to any type of success he might see this season?
That's going to be the extent of his scoring throughout the season, maybe?
Maybe. But last year, he starts with bodies who had no hope of cracking the roster. So is that a ringing endorsement, or are we reading into this too
much?
Sorry,
we're talking about Bo Horvat. In
Bo
this
Horvat,
case, right?
Not Matthias, yeah.
Maybe we're reading a little bit too much into that. I think Bo Horvat, like you and I have debated, and Clay debated again last week as well, Bo Horvat, I feel, is a stretch to make this roster. That said, I do find it interesting that Willie Desjardins was willing to start him on a line, or at least in line rushes, with Sean Matthias and Derek Dorsett, who we both know are going to be at least on this roster next, at the start of the season. So I think that it's interesting. Does it mean that Bo Horvat is a shoo-in by any means? No. But I think it shows some confidence, which I think at this stage of Bo Horvat's development, he really needs.
So Bo Horvat starting on the fourth line for, let's say, six games.
Where's Brad Richardson?
Maybe he's part of the 23. You know, the roster, like he's the guy that goes upstairs. But I hear, just hear me out.
Okay.
Bo Horvat spends six games on an NHL roster playing on the fourth line. And then he goes back to junior and is told straight up, this is what we're going to do. Here's the plan. We want to give you that exposure, give you a taste, show you what it's like so that you go back down and you build your game around that. Is there harm in this?
When you put it like that, no. I think giving him, like you said, that taste of what the NHL is all about in a real regular season situation, first of all, you're not burning off the first year of his entry-level contract, and second, like you said, you're giving him some much-needed experience. I think when you put it that way, it's a good thing for Bo Horvat. And then to be sent down to juniors. And again, he is still eligible to play for Canada at the World Juniors. So it's not like playing in London, like what we talked about, it's going to be a tough year for the Knights this year. It's not like playing in London is going to be a total write-off for Bo Horvat. That said, don't you feel he would be best served getting a ton of minutes down in London than getting 5 to 6 for six games in Vancouver?
Well, but that's, we're talking the start of a season, like even a junior season. I think there's plenty of opportunity for him to get ice time.
I guess so.
In junior. And where I worry, and this is, again, simply me surmising that maybe the plan is to keep him longer than that taste, how is playing him on the fourth line good for his development? If to the case that he's only going to get a few minutes, I'd rather he get ice time in London. Regardless, I mean, it's the first week of training camp, so there's still lots of action to take place. I just want to point out, as I mentioned in the last podcast, Cole Castles is there getting a look.
He's recovered from the mono, I see.
Well, it's enough to go and skate around with a few NHL players without getting hit, but yeah, he made it. So I obviously am an NHL insider. We've talked at length over the course of the summer whether or not this team has it in them to make the postseason. So instead of rehashing those old discussions, let's get into some rapid fire. So, Matt, Henrik Sedin goes on the record to suggest the Vancouver Canucks are a deeper team than they were last season. Do you agree?
All right. In comes Radim Verbata, Nick Bonino, Lyndon Vay, Derek Dorsett. They all replace Ryan Kesler. So if you look at the sheer numbers, yes, the Canucks have added more bodies to offset the loss of Kesler. There are now more readily available NHL players on this team than there were last year.
Well, Chris Higgins adds to the Henrik's remarks by saying he still believes the Canucks in the Canucks core. Do you believe in the Canucks core?
No more Luongo, no more Kesler. You can throw those names out of the group. This core, in my opinion, now belongs to Henrik, Daniel, Burrows, Bieksa, Hamhuis, and I would even throw Chris Higgins' name out there. I don't know. Do I have confidence that all six of those guys are going to rebound from last season? Yeah, because no one can do as worse as they did last season. But do I believe that now, a year older and a year wiser, they have enough to not only get back into the postseason, but knock off some of that top-grade Western Conference talent? Are you telling me that this team is going to beat or at least win a few games against Chicago, LA, St. Louis? That's an entirely different question.
Well, outside of the core, how many goals were Radim Vereda and Nick Bonino combined for this season?
45 goals are both reasonable for both players. Vrbata, I can see getting 25, and Bonino possibly getting 20. You know what? I liken Nick Bonino to the best that we ever saw from Mason Raymond, and I know that's not going to put a lot of faith in a lot of fans, but both are going to see tons of time on the power play and in the top six. You have to think that with few other weapons aside from the Sedins on this roster, Desjardins is going to be giving them the puck, at least until they throw up.
Well, I mean, regardless of the core and those two players, this Canucks team is deep. How many Canucks prospects are making the opening night roster?
This is a tough one, actually. But, and I'll let you answer this one too, but I think it's going to be zero. We don't have access to Jim Benning's wall of rosters, but I'm of the opinion he's going to let Bo Horvat go back to London, like you said, for one more year before letting him develop his game in the AHL. From what we've read, Hunter Shinkaruk has been impressive early in training camp, but even if he plays out of his mind, I think he's going to be in tough to wiggle his way through onto a forward unit, which we like we just mentioned, is a deep one. Nicholas Jensen may get a handful of games, but that's about it. What do you think very quickly?
Well, I just look at the names on the roster and CapGeek and the fact that every single one of them requires waivers. Lyndon Vay is your problem.
Yeah.
So, regardless of how he or anyone else does, they'd have to be lights out and then guarantee that that was going to be the case for the rest of the season. Regardless, if you were to pick a forward who you think takes a leap forward in terms of production, who is that?
The sexy pick is Zach Cassian. And I don't want to put sexy with Zach Cassian in terms of wording, but this is
brown cow.
Okay. This is his fourth season, though, and I think a lot of people have suggested over the course of the NHL's history that the fourth year of an NHL player's career is a very crucial one in terms of development and in terms of breakout. Cassian, still young, still impressionable. He made some progress over the tail end of last season, as we saw with David Booth, and he has a real opportunity, really, to thrive under the tutelage of a head coach in Willie Desjardins. Now, I'm not knocking John Tortorella, but Zach Cassian himself would tell you that perhaps what John Tortorella was preaching last season didn't always make a whole lot of sense. This time, Desjardins is going to get every ounce of effort out of Cassian and a lot of this team's players, so Cassian's my pick.
Okay, so which player is under the most pressure to rebound from last season?
Oh, where do you begin? You could start with the Sedins, but they're your top-line players already to begin with. If you had to pick only one, you would suggest Alex Burrows, given his lack of production, but given he was injury-riddled almost all of last season, you can cut him some slack. So the guy with the most to prove, in my mind, seems to be Alex Edler. He had 22 points in 63 games last year, which is the equivalent of watching the Titanic mark a slow and steady course face first into the front of an iceberg. Edler was blasted over the summer, of course, was the height of a ton of trade speculation. You all remember the Detroit scuttlebutt, and therefore he has the most to prove.
Well, this is Ryan Miller's first season in the Goalie Gong Show of Vancouver, so how does that play out?
It should and will be drama-free, at least in terms of actual playing time. Eddie Lack appears cemented, like you and I have talked about already, as the team's number two, although the possibility of carrying three goalies with Jacob Markstrom in tow is far from ideal. Miller should at least be a solid presence in the blue paint, but how his aggressive style jives with goalie coach Rolly Melanson could make for some entertaining moments.
Well, you know what wasn't entertaining last season? It was the Canucks special teams unit. So what special teams unit is most likely to improve? Is it the 26th ranked power play or the 28th ranked penalty kill?
Those are some horrible numbers, by the way. It sounds like assistant coach Glenn Gullitson shifting his responsibilities this season towards improving the penalty kill, which from what I've read is more up his alley. It's hard to imagine doing any worse than being the third worst penalty killing team in the league. That said, looking at the number of injuries this team was plagued with up front, the power play should also improve if the forwards can even stay remotely healthy.
Third worst. It could be the second worst or the worst. finish the sentence. The Vancouver Canucks will make the playoffs if
they get good coaching. Willie Desjardins is a brand new coach who's going to implement a brand new system. Mind you, it doesn't appear on the surface to be too much different than what Alain Vigneault had installed for so many years. But to go from John Tortorella's clown car of confusion to a system that actually makes sense could result in a slow transition period. It's being called an instant diary inside look at the Canucks' meteoric rise to the top of the NHL and their dramatic post-riot fall to mediocrity, all at a time when new efforts are being launched to save the once great team. Ice Storm, which chronicles the rise and fall of the greatest Vancouver Canucks team ever, is now available wherever books are sold, and we're pleased to be joined by the book's author, Bruce Dobing. And Bruce, how are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you for joining us here on the show. Bruce, first off, take us through the journey and what inspired you to write this book, because as you know, there are obviously a lot of Canuck fans who are incredibly intrigued.
Well, I've known Mike Gillis for a long time from doing research on Allan Eagleson and things of that nature. I met Mike when he was in court against Eagleson and have sort of followed his career as an agent. In one of my earlier books, Money Players, I sat with him when he was negotiating a bunch of contracts, and you know, I've gotten to know him and kind of respected and liked what he was doing. I thought he had a different take. And, you know, when I would talk to him, we'd always talk about, well, you know, if you ran a team, what would you do? And well, finally he got a chance to run the Canucks and put his ideas in play. And we sort of planned the book as something like a Moneyball book about somebody with different ideas and a different approach. For 4 or 5 years, it was working out marvelously until, of course, the last year with the John Tortorella year, and then everything just sort of fell apart.
Yeah, and you know, there are also a lot of fans who have an idea of how this book ends, and you know, spoiler alert, it's not a happy ending for anybody. This book also, again, like you mentioned, focuses a lot on Mike, who went from, like you said, being a former player agent to becoming the GM of his own team that was, you know, that close to winning it all. Have you talked to Mike recently?
He's not talking on the record with anybody. He's got his settlement with the Canucks, and I think he's decided that he'll keep his peace. I had a lot of access to him during the writing of the book. I had access to the owner and a bunch of people along the way, and the Canucks were very kind and very open with me. This certainly isn't a hatchet job or an attempt to rip somebody down. It was an attempt to talk about an organization, whether it was the owners or the general manager, the coaches, and the players. Who had a different idea about how to do things. And as people in Vancouver very well know, for a while it worked quite well. And, you know, I just say in the book that had the game in 2011 gone differently, had the Canucks won and not the Bruins, you know, all the people in the league, because it's a copycat league, that they would have looked at the Canucks and imitated what the Canucks were doing. But because they lost that final game, just one game, the league looked at Boston and said, well, I guess that's what we've got to do. And I think that was an unfair judgment on the Canucks, the methods they had chosen and the sort of changes they had made, really, to pro hockey.
I know you said you don't want to sort of step on the settlement agreement with Mike and the Vancouver Canucks, but do you have an idea of what he's been up to lately or how he's doing?
I think he's just basically getting over it. I don't think he'd be surprised if I said that he's that he was upset and was disappointed and just basically considering his options going forward as to what he wants to do. I mean, one of the things we talk about in the book is Mike always said, look, I'm not a serial GM. I'm not in this to get another job, then another job after that. He'd done very well as an agent. Financially, he was secure. His kids are pretty much grown up. So it's not like he had to go and find another job right away. And that's why the Vancouver thing was so important to him, was he just wanted to have one place where he could put this into play, where there were the resources, and the Aquilinis were always generous in supplying the money. So, you know, the idea of him going and somewhere right away is a knee jerk just to prove, oh, well, you know, he can do it. I think he's just still thinking that over.
You sort of touched on this already, but do you feel that Mike will get an offer to be a GM somewhere in the league again?
Mike, I can't say I know for sure. I would suspect that there would be people who would be interested in what he had done. I think that people understand the dynamic of the situation and what was happening in Vancouver, a couple of the situations. I mean, there was a whole linchpin to that, to the situation that I think precipitated the fall, and I don't think anybody in Vancouver is surprised, was the Roberto Luongo situation. From day one, he was a controversial goalie. I think people were never completely satisfied with him as the number one goalie in the first couple of years when they lost to Chicago. I think people felt if he played better, they had a better chance. A lot of people in 2011 know for sure that if he played better, the Canucks would have had a better chance. And then, of course, all of the contractual stuff that happened with Corey Schneider on the surface and coming to the surface and basically being the guy they decided they should go with. And, he's the guy. If there's a subtitle to this book, it's, you know, what Roberto Luongo did to the Vancouver Canucks.
Wow, I mean that brings me to my next question here then. Do you feel that Mike Gillis shouldn't shoulder all the blame here, or should some of that blame lie on Roberto Luongo's shoulders for not getting the job done?
Oh, I think there's lots of people who are responsible, you know. Everybody has to wear a coat of the stuff that the decisions that they make and going forward, and this is no exception. And Mike, I think, would admit to the mistakes and the things that didn't work out. But here's the thing about Luongo is that, you know, he was just a good enough goalie to break your heart at the elite level. You know, he's a top-notch goalie, but somehow he never really had that ability especially in 11, to really turn things around and to hold the team in there. And, you know, because it's a salary cap league, you've got Schneider. The situation is that in a salary cap league, you've got a guy 4 years younger. He's making half as much money, and he's as good. Some people might say even better. In a salary cap league, you've got to move Roberto Luongo. That's where Roberto's dug in his heels and basically said, okay, that's fine, but I only want to go to Florida because that's where my wife is from. And unfortunately, the Florida Panthers were bankrupt at the time, and they spent about 18 months trying to make an accommodation to get Roberto somewhere, anywhere, and he wanted to be in Florida. And by the time, of course, if Roberto understood that he couldn't get to Florida, it was too late. They had the lockout. They changed the rules about the long-term contracts, and the Canucks were stuck.
Mike, I know Chris has a couple burning questions here that he'd like to ask you, so I'll let Chris take the next
couple. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, Bruce, just getting back to the book there, we obviously don't want you to give away the details of the book, but could you give us a little teaser as to where exactly things just fell apart? I mean, you look at how the Canucks were built up, and I think everyone and their dog was talking about how even after that Stanley Cup run, they were going for another run the following season. That didn't occur.
Well, I mean, two things here. First, I just explained about the Luongo thing. I still, I think that's the linchpin of what happened to the franchise. I think it produced a schism in ownership and management about what to do with him, where to go with the contract, how you make a solution. I mean, if you remember in the early days, the Luongo contract was considered actually a pretty good idea because they managed to get him at an annual salary cap hit that was less than the Sedins. It allowed them to add other people. Yes, it had a long term and you'd have to pay him at the back end, but people saw it as a smart deal, I think, in the front end. And I think that's one of the key things that really went wrong, and it produced a sort of a chain of events where Alain Vigneault ended up getting fired. John Tortorella was brought in because people thought, well, we need a guy who's a sort of an in-your-face kind of guy after Alain Vigneault. I think that's really kind of the linchpin to this. But the other part of it, I think, is the nature of the Vancouver hockey market. Every Canadian hockey market is volatile. I mean, I've lived in Montreal, Toronto, Ottawa, Calgary. I've spent a lot of time in Vancouver. And Vancouver is a really volatile market. And I just think that the failure of the team sort of obscures really how good the team was. I mean, you're talking about five division titles. You're talking about twice the President's Cup winners. You're talking about a team that was competitive and a team that made tons of money for its owners. And yet people in Vancouver just seemed to sour on it. They just, I guess the bar got set too high. I don't know how to explain it.
So could it be fair to say that, you know, our market, and I'm a diehard Vancouver Canucks fan. It's the only market I've ever lived in. But would you say that we, maybe as a market, set our expectations so high that we, as a fan base, can drive the team to make decisions that might not be in the best interest of the long-term game?
A little bit. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, Calgary, Edmonton, almost every other Canadian NHL city has a Stanley Cup. So even in your darkest hour, you can always get out the film of the 89 Calgary Flames or mm-hmm. or any of the Oilers ones or the Canadiens, etc. Vancouver's never won, and Mike talked about it on the day he was hired. He was concerned about kind of a defeatist attitude in the community, that people were just, you know, the people had never won, and their default to everything was, well, we're going to lose, and so we better not get our hopes up. And I think in some ways what happened was almost a negative wish fulfillment for the Vancouver market. That, oh gosh, you know, we don't want to have our hearts broken. And so they got very negative about the team, I think almost getting themselves ready for the fact that they mightn't win. And it's a unique kind of thing. I don't want to pick on Vancouver. It's a great city and the fans are terrific. But, you know, I don't think they understood how good things were when they were good.
Mm-hmm. Bruce, I think I could summarize up those thoughts just now as brutal honesty. But you know what? That's what we're after right now, is some brutal honesty. Do you feel like this team is a team that has fans that are used to its, you know, caving in on itself there with that negative attitude?
Well, I mean, that's the challenge any management has had. And, you know, there's a passage, there's a chapter in the book where I sort of write the history of the team and talk about how this kind of mindset came to be. And it's going to be the challenge for all of these guys. I mean, I know the ownership has gotten Trevor in there because they know he's popular with the fans, et cetera. But it's something that he's going to have to face in the oncoming years. It's just this whole kind of, I don't call it negativity, but it's almost death wish fulfillment about hockey in Vancouver, that people think it can never end well for them. And I mean, it was so close in 2011, and it was a great team. And I think the other thing that people have to understand, and Vancouver's like any other market, is we're living in a very different hockey kind of environment now, where you get a window of about 5 to 7 years, unless you're extremely lucky, you get 5 to 7 years to make it happen, and then you've got to retool. And what we were seeing in the last 2 years, the last year of Vino and the first year of Tortorella, the only year of Tortorella, was, I think, the transition started to happen. And if you look at it, I think 18 months from now, and we see where Bo Horvat is, and we see where Shinkarik and a lot of the guys that were being produced in the farm system coming up, I think you'll see that there was a transition in place. It's just that people got impatient for it and got negative about it.
One of the last questions about 2011 that I'm going to ask you, Bruce, I've talked to a lot of people about it since it happened. Was the Vancouver Canucks 2011 team the best team to ever not win the Stanley Cup?
Certainly one of them. Certainly, I mean, there's a few teams that probably feel that way. The Detroit Red Wings back in the 90s had a few teams that should have won the Stanley Cup and didn't. And listen, if you want my feeling about why they didn't win, I think they just ran out of healthy bodies. I think Roberto Luongo was out goaltended, and I think the Canucks ran out of healthy bodies. They were down 4, maybe 5 regulars, and a whole bunch of other guys were hurt for that final series. And that, to me, as much as anything, that was why they didn't win. And thus, I don't think you should look at the team and say, oh, well, yeah, their strategy and all those things don't work. I think it was a matter of healthy bodies and Roberto Luongo's goaltending. I mean, guy had 2 shutouts in the finals, but was giving up 7 and 8 goals in other games. I mean, that's a tough way to win.
So back to the question of innovation, and I think this is sort of more of the trend of what we see in a lot of the Canadian NHL teams going. You had mentioned earlier that when you were writing the book with Mike, and the idea was around sort of that money ball idea, and we are seeing the era of money puck where advanced analytics are coming into play. Is that something that Mike would have been appreciative? Because I know the questions had come up in the past in the media here, and he didn't really give much of an answer.
Well, the whole organization, I think, I don't want to just say Mike. I mean, mm-hmm. Lawrence Gilman, I think Alain Vigneault, I think they all were looking at analytics. I think they were on the cutting edge of it. There were other organizations who were doing as much, but they were one of the cutting organizations. And I talk about it a little bit in the book, just, you know, how the Sedins were handled in the years under Vigneault, mm-hmm. and how it worked out for them. And one of the things that nobody talks about, which I think was hugely important, of course, was the injury to Manny Malhotra. When Manny Malhotra was healthy, the Canucks could always start him in defense, give him defensive zone starts. He was terrific at getting the puck and getting the puck out of your own zone. From the time Malhotra's eye was injured and he couldn't play anymore, all of a sudden that balance in the Canucks, where the Sedins would start in the offensive zone and Malhotra would start in the defensive zone, that balance was upset. And that was a product of analytics. The decisions that were made there, that's a product of analytics. And I think it's a pretty clear example of some of the stuff that they were doing that was innovative. And again, I say, you know, not just Mike, the people throughout the organization. And now in perspective, Alain Vigneault, I think people understand just how good a coach he was.
Before we let you go, Bruce, I mean, you've touched on this earlier, and I'm sure you've mentioned it in your book. Last year, a train wreck and a half for the Vancouver Canucks. It obviously resulted in Mike Gillis's firing, John Tortorella lasting just one season. Many new faces have now been ushered in that time. What's your gut telling you now about this team, its future, and the direction they're trying to go in?
Well, I think there's some real tools to rebuild. I mean, I like the selection of Virtanen by the new organization, the new guys in the organization. I like some of the kids who are coming up. But again, like everybody else, they're going to have to transition. And I think it'll be very tough for them to even get in the playoffs in the West. You see Calgary's improving. You see the Edmonton Oilers. I mean, they can't screw things up every year. They'll be pushing to get better. So it's going to be very tough for them. And that's kind of a natural transition. And I think the problem that happened in the last year, the thing that really upset things was when some of the blame started getting on the ownership, we started hearing stories about that maybe the owners were being involved in trades, that the owners were making this decision and that decision. And whether that was true or not, that was very embarrassing, I think, to the ownership group, to the Aquilinis. I think it really exacerbated a lot of the problems that were already there.
Ice Storm, it follows the journey that led the Canucks from the top of the mountain to the bottom of the abyss in six short years, as the book says. Bruce Dobigan, our guest at this time. You can follow him on Twitter at Doughboy. Reminder that Ice Storm is available where all books are sold, and if you have a strong stomach or you're at least curious and an inside look into where it all went wrong for the Vancouver Canucks, we encourage you to buy a copy. Bruce, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks. Well, there's lots in there that's pleasant stuff, too. Some pleasant memories, I hope.
The first few chapters.
Yeah, exactly.
Just the ending we know is not going to be too pleasant.
No, that's for sure. That's for sure.
Bruce Dobigan, again, and our guest at this time. We'll be back with more after this timeout.
The whole year, I mean, leading up to the trade deadline, I, you know, thinking that something's going to happen, and then hearing that it happened and not happening. Obviously, it's hard. It's something that I've never dealt with before, but you know, it was definitely a learning curve, and I think, you know, made me a better person because of it.
It's tough to say at this point, but I mean, do you have any regrets about the way you did, you know, act after the trade did not happen? Was there?
No, I didn't. Basically, told the media that I didn't want to talk about it, and you know, for the most part, they respected that, and obviously, you know, the rest of the season, we're out of the playoffs pretty quick there, so that was something that none of my old teammates dealt with before. We were never out of the playoffs that early, so that part was tough.
All right, Chris, let's dig into what the liar said.
The liar.
That's how we're going to start this, because you know what? I'm not buying Ryan Kessler's clown car of lies. Lies, lies. Okay? What do you think? He said at the trade deadline, after the trade deadline had passed, I'm happy here. My son grew up in Vancouver. I'm happy here.
So did you expect...
Does it sound like a guy who sounded happy in Vancouver?
No, not at the end, of course, but would you expect that he say otherwise? Yeah, guys, all the Vancouver media, all the Vancouver fans, I hate this place. This place is a hole. It's a beautiful city. I want out. He's
Look,
not going to go
I don't
and say
think,
that.
I think people would have at least appreciated some semblance of honesty from Ryan Kessler. If you wanted a trade, you could just say, we can talk about it after the season. I'm focused on trying to get my team perilously into the playoffs.
But that's never been Ryan Kessler's style. I mean, he's at best gruff. And if you want to say honesty is grunt, sure. But regardless of the situation, the players are far too educated when it comes to public relations. There are people in their ear telling them what to say. Everything is a soundbite. And the last thing that he would go and say is, honestly, oh, I love the city. The people are great. I hate the team. I don't want to be here any longer. It's not going to come out.
I don't know. I mean, what do you think of Ryan Kessler saying, though, that, you know, he was frustrated? He was definitely frustrated with last season and that, you know, these trade demands and this.
Well, I've got no issue with him being frustrated with last season. I was frustrated and I didn't even play.
Ryan Kessler, what kind of reception do you think he's going to get when he gets back to Vancouver for the first time?
My guess? Oh, he's going to get booed. He's turned into the new Sean Pronger. Or not Sean Pronger. Chris Pronger.
Sean Pronger. Does he deserve it?
No, but we have short-term memories here, and frankly, I'll look at Roberto Luongo. Everyone knew Roberto Luongo wanted out of Vancouver, and I think Vancouver fans were completely accepting of the fact that he wanted out and wanted to be traded. But the way Roberto positioned himself was like, hey, here's why I want out, this is why, and I'm going to have fun while I'm here, and I think his personality was conducive, especially considering he all of a sudden had personality. Ryan Kesler has never had that warm and fuzzy personality. I've only ever run into him once in an elevator, and he seemed like a nice enough guy, but every other interaction I've ever had is him on the TV with media, and I can't say he's been the most friendly of folks. Now, take into consideration how he left, where he went and had his agent whittle the list down from, what was it, 8 teams to 6 to 2, and really one of them was never in on the race. So it's like, I want to go here or else. If I'm a Vancouver Canucks fan, which I am, and I am a diehard Vancouver Canucks fan who loves the lunch bucket style that he brought, that lunch bucket style also pisses me off. When someone doesn't want to be here, get the F out.
That's harsh.
Well, and that's the way I look at it. Like, if you don't want to be here, we don't want you. And that's
what Jim Benning said when he traded him.
Yeah, that's actually why I like Jim Benning all of a sudden. I like him for a lot more than that. But it's that, yeah, this is, you don't want to be here. Why would you want to be? We want you to be here. And it goes both ways. Jason Garrison, who, when he was asked to waive his no trade, originally thought, well, why would I want to do that? Well, wait, they don't want me? I don't want to be here. I respect Garrison saying yes to that because it works both ways. Whereas with Kesler, it didn't. He had a no trade clause. Granted, he negotiated that. Good for him. He shouldn't have to go and say, yes to any type of deal. But he goes to the team and says, I have a no trade clause, but I want to go there, make that happen. That's not how it works.
What do you think? We didn't get the clip of it, but Ryan Kesler suggested that, you know, his relationship with his now former teammates was okay. He said 95% of his teammates texted him wishing him luck. What 5% do you think didn't text him, first of all?
Well, first of all, they're 95% of Ryan Kesler's numbers, so who is he, you know, including? But regardless, it does bring up the 5%. Yeah, there are some who didn't. So there's obviously some, either, maybe it's someone who just doesn't care. Like, you know, I'm the type of person, if you don't text me, I might not text you back type idea. I'm not just going to reach out. But I'm thinking those numbers are pumped up. Because again, he's like, you know, the team liked me, 4% texted me, or 45% or 60%. You know, you go and say some high number. Regardless, I mean, they're Ryan Kesler's numbers. He doesn't occur to me to be the type of player that all players that he's played with have appreciated.
Last thing on Ryan Kesler before we start to get ready to wrap up this show. How do you think he's going to do in Anaheim? I mean, this is a guy who has flirted with 40 goals before twice in his career. He was once heralded as the best two-way center in the game. Do you think that he will enjoy that kind of success in Anaheim, or is this more like a 50-point situation where he'll be a two-way center backing up Ryan Getzlaff?
Well, I see two things at play, both of which relate to Ryan Kesler and how well he produces. The first situation is that Ryan Kesler seems to be the type of guy that plays much better with a chip on his shoulder, and I think in going to Anaheim, having some freedom, some flexibility, the new environment, and the fact that he's probably going to want to prove to Vancouver, who unfortunately we get to go and, you know, see him more often than not, that he is the player that we allowed to go. But the other situation, and this is actually more relative to what Solani has recently said about Bruce Boudreau, and ultimately, how does that interact with Kesler?
Well, here's what I think on Ryan Kessler's situation with coaches. I think he's a guy who has to have the right coach to his game. And like you said, Timo Solani had some interesting things to say about Bruce Boudreau. And, you know, the way that Ryan Kesler didn't sort of jive under John Tortorella's quote-unquote system last year leads me feeling very skittish about how he's going to do with Bruce Boudreau this year in Anaheim. That said, he's not being asked to be the guy in Anaheim. That has always been Ryan Getzlaff and Corey Perry as the meal ticket. So from that standpoint, he's going to be asked to just be a second-line center, which isn't going to be as high profile as being the second-line center in Vancouver behind Henrik Sedin, because unlike Henrik Sedin, Ryan Getzlaff and Corey Perry are still in the prime of their careers.
Okay, so you're just saying happy times, happy Kesler?
I'm not going to say happy times, happy Kesler, but I think that he is motivated to win. There's no doubting that. And the fact that the Anaheim Ducks should at least be considered Stanley Cup contenders does lead me to believe that he will be moderately happy in this season because he's focused on winning a Stanley Cup.
Well, here we have it. Great episode there, Matt. We covered a lot. We got training camp in there. We just talked about Kessler. We had Bruce Dabigan on the phone. I think we did pretty well for ourselves this week.
I think we did pretty well for ourselves as well. You know, next week, by the time we record this podcast, we're going to be getting into preseason action very quickly here.
Dun, dun, dun.
It's coming up quick, isn't it?
It is. A split squad in San Jose, and then from there, I was looking at the schedule. It's like every second night the Canucks are playing.
It's good to have real, tangible hockey to talk about, isn't it?
It is. It makes our job a whole lot easier instead of us having to have Clay talk about Canucks haiku, for instance. Not to knock haiku, but, you know, we can actually talk Canucks.
We're also looking forward to bringing back Ask CHB this season.
Well, we are, and I know we'll have Canucks haiku, but I think a lot of times we're just creating filler, but it's going to be great that we no longer have to do that for the summer. I mean, at one point, I thought we were going to start talking about WWE.
We could have talked about WWE.
That would have been pretty darn cool. Like, actually, and speaking of WWE, this is something we got to do for a future episode. CM Punk, big Blackhawks fan.
I can get you Bruce Dalbiggin. Now you're asking me to get you CM Punk.
Well, you're an awesome producer, Matt.
You reach out to him on Twitter and you see if we can get him on.
Hey, Punk, I want you to drop a pipe bomb on C4 from CHB. I'm sure he'd be all over it. You are looking at me with a gaze of uncertainty.
I'm looking at you with a gaze of an idea more than anything.
See, you know exactly why this is such a good idea.
Okay, well, you know what? You work your magic with him and you can tell me, because I don't have his email or his phone number.
Well,
they don't actually list it up in some sort of magic former wrestler directory.
Well, still, he's on Twitter, and he actually talks to his fans. Hey, Punk, you know, longtime fan, great wrestler. I understand you like hockey. You want to come talk hockey?
I think we know how we're going to promote the next podcast.
What?
We're going to be calling out CM Punk and asking him to drop a pipe bomb on the C4 CHB podcast.
That would be by far the best episode ever. Anyhow, we've made it to the end of the podcast episode here, and I think we've, as I said earlier, had a great one. But I am Chris Golden wrapping things up. You can find me on Twitter. I am at LightForest, joined with producer Matt Lee, who is at MattLee980. You can find us at Canucks Hockey on Twitter and CanucksHockeyBlog.com or on Facebook, Facebook.com/CanucksHockeyBlog. Any final words there, Matt?
Get CM Punk on this podcast, and I will hail you as king forever, Chris Golden.
Well, how about this for a pipe bomb? We're out.